Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable and 2 hour panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It's Wednesday, the 14th of June, and well, it's about time. We got to the middle of June and here we are, and I thank you very much for being with us. I also thank you for taking part in the program, as many of you do. All you have to do is write to us. You can do that by writing to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will get to letters at some point, and then we'll get to as many as we possibly can. We don't get to every letter, so don't get mad at me. All right, let me introduce the group. Immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
That's really good to have you here. Thank you very much. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, Joe. Good to be back. Great job on the fund drive.
Thank you.
Also very excited this weekend. The Grateful Dead family comes back into the region. So welcome, everybody.
Now, am I right? Are you going, right?
I am going.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is this your first foray to SPAC?
This is my first time to SPAC. Yeah, I started watching the Dead in the early 80s, though. So I go back.
We knew that. Yeah. But, I think it'll be great. Yeah, they're doing two shows, right?
Saturday and Sunday.
So. You doing both? Or?
Yes, I'm. Yeah, wow. Not miss the opportunity.
So cool,
yeah.
Do you buy T-shirts when you're there?
Occasionally. I think the final tour, I probably will get a few.
I might
be buried in one too at some point. But welcome, everybody. The region's wonderful. We're looking forward to seeing the family back.
Yeah, it'd be very nice to have everybody here, especially if the weather cooperates. Corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
That's really nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
Thank you very much. We have a newbie, brand new panelist, and we're very excited to welcome Nick to the program. Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm well. Good. It's really great to have you on the program. So tell us a little bit about yourself. We know that you're Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society, but how did you get to that position?
First, I want to say that my husband and I just booked a weekend in Cooperstown when the Grateful Dead are going to be in town down there, too. So it's really fun. I don't know. I'm just excited. This is my 6 month anniversary as executive director at Legal Aid. I was previously a deputy counsel for the New York State Senate majority. I was in the Senate for about 8 years. Before that, I institutionalized pro bono programming at Albany Law School as the first pro bono fellow. And before that, I worked at Legal Aid as a clerk. And my supervisor at that time is still there and is still a good friend of mine, and I feel very lucky to get to work with that whole team again.
Well, as we were getting ready to go on the air, Bob looked at me and caught my eye and said, "You know, you and I are the only two here who aren't lawyers, so watch it." Okay, I will.
Thorns among roses, Joe.
Yeah, that's right. Give us a sense of the great work that Legal Aid Society does.
Absolutely. So Legal Aid Society has about 110 staff that serve 16 counties in upstate New York. We have 6 offices, Albany, Saratoga, Amsterdam, Gloversville, Plattsburgh, and Canton. And we also serve the St. Regis Mohawk Reservation up in St. Lawrence. So we cover really kind of a triangle of upstate New York. And I like to call the offices in Albany the lower decks and Plattsburgh and Canton the upper. But
I'm sure everyone in Albany loves that and privately understands.
I worked there in law school.
Did you really?
Yes. I clerked at Legal Aid. It's got to be like 1983 or something like that. Like my second year in law school for Susan Antos, who's still in that realm.
Yeah, and she's now at Empire Justice Center. Worked at Empire Justice Center with her one time, too. But we provide free civil legal services to low-income people. Those kind of services range across about 15 different programs. It's housing and eviction, foreclosure, consumer protection, domestic violence, family law. We have a tax program, the low-income tax program. We have an education law project and a number of other very, very important programs that we run by county largely.
So a lot going on, and we are thrilled that you have taken time out of your day to be with us this morning. I appreciate it. All right, let's get into the news of the day. Rich has to leave us at 10 o'clock, so I want to get in as many thoughts.
Let's get all the anti-Trump stuff out in the next 40 minutes if we can.
Half the Rich. Half of Rich Honan's time and half the letters that we get, so it'll be interesting. Well, the former president of the United States was arraigned yesterday, charged in a classified documents case. And things went pretty much according to plan. It was a little bit of a circus atmosphere in the city of Miami, but for the most part, it went as was expected. Donald Trump lashed out at former federal prosecutors and portrayed himself as a victim of political persecution hours after pleading not guilty in a Miami court to charges that he illegally retained and shared classified national security documents after leaving the White House. Quote, "Today we witness the most evil and heinous abuse of power in the history of our country," Trump said Tuesday night at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, surrounded by supporters and a crush of reporters, capping an extraordinary day in which the former president and 2024 GOP frontrunner sought to capitalize on the attention in the case. "This day will go down in infamy," Trump said. He made a number of claims, including that he had the right to take the documents with him to his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida, though he said they were in boxes of personal items, including news clips and photographs, that he didn't have a chance to go through them all. Bob Griffin?
Yeah, so, you know, it's more of the Trump playbook, right? The charges are absurd. I'm being persecuted. Then I have the right to do it. Then, yeah, I did it, but it's no big deal. I mean, it's the same rollout that we've seen time and time again. You know, for folks that may not have been following the story, you know, basically he's being charged with having documents that he shouldn't have had, and then sharing them with other people and directing staff to hide them. You know, one of the questions that I would love somebody to ask him is that if he felt he really had the right to these documents, why did he feel like he had to keep hiding them? You know, so there's a lot of those cover-ups or sort of questionable activities. A couple of points that I'd like to toss on the table, and I'd be interested in sort of understanding a little bit more from our attorney friends on the panel. The magistrate made a point in yesterday's proceeding, reminding Trump's legal team that they cannot now pull out of the case even if they're not paid. I was just wondering, is that normal, or is that addressing Trump's typical or sort of pattern of not paying his attorneys or workers?
Rich or Santa, go ahead. I heard.
Well, once you file as entry into your appearance as an attorney in court, you know, I'm in criminal court and federal court, that you have to get the permission of the judge to leave. So what they're saying is you can't submit a motion to me withdraw based on non-payment. I mean, that's just not a good basis to withdraw as counsel. You need more than that.
So it's stock language then.
Yeah.
Well, I will say it is stock. When they really make a big deal out of it is when someone else has already withdrawn.
Exactly.
Which I thought some people withdrew. I thought he had some.
He was having issues with Pro Hoc Vitae.
Yeah.
Getting local counsel. And local counsel was like pulling out, trying to get counsel in. He was having issues with that.
Right. So judges will, I agree. And in my experience, especially when you're coming into a case where someone else has already gotten out, or you're coming in where, especially if the other attorney is getting out because they were not paid, the judge will say, okay, but understand, I'm not putting up with this again. Once you are in, you are in. And don't come to me and be all surprised when he doesn't pay you or when he turns on you, you know, or something like that. So it makes a lot of sense in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also important to note that this judge was just the magistrate. He duty judge for the day, right? Judge Cannon is the judge overseeing. She's the one assigned the orders on Pro Hoc Vice for the counsel. So she's really the one that's going to be making those final decisions on motions to withdraw.
And there's two cases I just want to toss on the table so we could talk more about. One, you know, Robert Burkham was sentenced to 3 years in prison for keeping classified documents. That sounded very similar to that. That was done in April. In June. And then in April, Special Forces Officer Jeremy Brown was sentenced to 7 years for exactly the same case. So I'll be really interested to see how this whole thing rolls out. And I could tell you, Joe, given my past, if I had a single document, I'd be facing jail time.
And with and you've had security clearance.
I have had security clearances.
And had access to classified information.
Yes.
So that's where that comes from.
And I would note in those cases, I believe they cooperated in that case. They gave everything back. It was, you know, so I think there's a distinction to be made. There.
But they still got seven.
They still got
seven.
Yes,
they
still got
3 years.
Exactly.
I mean, that so.
And one of them was in Florida.
Yes. That was the June 1st case,
yes,
correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Rich?
Yeah, look, I'll skip the right-wing talking points of, you know, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. No, let's just assume they've all been said.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I agree with everything that's been said. Remember when Trump made first of all, he's just so nuanced, isn't he? He's just he's so subtle. But you know, when he made that statement early on, he's like, I'm so popular, I could go out and shoot somebody. And I think, you know, it's almost like he's bent on doing that. I think that he's trying to see how many laws he can be alleged to have broken. You know, it gets quickly to me. It gets quickly to, you know, the political implications. You know, what's going to happen? I mean, the case is the case. You know, if you know, the allegations are pretty clear. You know, and he's already, I think, gone out of his way to undercut some of his defenses. I think the Wall Street Journal made that point in an editorial today. And so, the only question of any interest is, you know, do his people still hang on? Do the Trump supporters in a primary still hang on, you know, to the death?
They have to, because he has two options. Either he pleads, or you push this trial as far as you can until you get elected. He has two options, really, yeah, because the case, but he's going to be convicted on one of those, not 37, because not all of them are his, but one of those counts, right? One of them. And let's, God forbid, that his Nott, I think it's pronounced Nott, right?
Yeah.
With Walter Nott, if he turns on him, if he flips, oh my gosh. No, he either pleads or he pushes it with the help of Judge Cannon until it gets too close to election to even have it in good faith. And then once he becomes elected, then he doesn't have to deal with it. I think those are his two primary options, because this is one case where it is, the witnesses are strong. You're dealing with attorneys testifying. You have documents, you have recordings, you have video. I mean, this is like a bad episode of Law and Order that ends really really soon. They solve the case and most of the episode is the trial. You know those episodes where they solve it really quickly? That is what we're dealing with here. And so I think, like, either
TikTok version of
the TikTok version of Law and Order. So I think he should take a plea deal. I hope that's what his counsel is talking to him about, is taking a plea deal, trying to get him as little or no jail time as possible and pleading to a couple of the charges and moving on. But I don't think it's going to happen.
I think it's telling that DeSantis has already come out and said, if I get elected, I promise I'll pardon Donald Trump, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think
it
says a lot about anyone's faith in him coming out clean on this.
I wouldn't be shocked if he declines to waive his speedy trial and actually pushes it along. That would not shock
really?
Me. Yeah.
Why would...
Just
well, for the circus.
Yeah, I mean, first, I don't know that it gets, you know, speedy is, you know,
relative.
Yeah, it is. I mean, right, because at some point there's going to be some kind of interlocutory, some kind of appeal that takes place on some arcane piece of evidence or privilege. I mean, the privilege issues are probably pretty chunky, you know, and I'm just saying, you know, that there's a lot there. So
yeah,
I think he in public, I don't disagree with you from a legal standpoint. But from a from electoral standpoint,
even with Georgia sitting out there, though,
yeah, absolutely, it wouldn't shock me, because this seems to be his game plan. You know, everybody's, you know, I spoke the truth, and now everybody's against me. That's, you know, I'm not, I'm saying, I think that's the game plan. It would not shock me if he said, I want to go to trial right now, you know, and see how far they push it. I'm not saying it's a good idea, but I don't know that it's a bad idea.
I mean, it depends. It depends on the jury pool that they get. But, you know, it's going to be you're going to go through voir dire, and they're going to both sides are going to have the opportunity to choose the jury. And so I think based on the evidence, I think it gets there to that beyond a reasonable doubt. Just reading the indictment, it was just so telling. I mean, even if they get one of the people who he talked to about the documents, I'm sorry, to testify, I mean, that in and of itself is another count. Right? So you have to think all of these different counts must go up. All must go up.
Let's pause there. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We're going to go over to news with the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And we have a great panel this morning. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, and Rich Honan. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. One of the things that we were talking about during the break, which I thought was interesting, Bob Griffin, was your remark that you expected perhaps a bigger crowd.
Yeah, I did. I thought that it would be a little more organized and that they would try to show some numbers in support that seems to be part of the energy that Donald Trump thrives on, that idea of being absolutely beloved. Now, let's be kind. It was ridiculously hot and muggy. It was Miami. The other observation was one that I heard, and I believe it was on CNN, so I can't remember which commentator made it, but how difficult it is to organize a mass event, and what that says about the January 6th insurrection and the planning that went into it. But I expected to see more than the crowd, and I expected to see a little bit more hardcore than sort of the circus Trump. Trumpeteers that were there.
So who benefits on the Republican primary side, if anybody? Does Trump benefit?
From his charges?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think the charges are a little bit too heady for many people to really understand what they mean. It's like talking about taxes. And so, there's only so far the, like, what about Hillary and what about Biden gets you. And after that, people are a little bit unsure of what it means other than the Espionage Act, right?
Yeah. But they're a bunch of, the rest of the field's a bunch of suckerfish that are hoping the shark dies, right? I mean, that's the only thing. I mean, that's the only thing that's the only thing that they got going for them.
Eloquent.
Not one of them has a shot at it. So even,
I think you just described my 30s.
I think it's his to lose, that he's got a base that no matter what he does, they're going to apologize for his vile behavior, and it's enough to lock in the nomination. Now the question is, how badly does it turn off the rest of the country? And I think that's the million-dollar question.
I don't know, because you're starting to see people turn away from Trump, and I'm looking to see who they're looking towards. You saw Paul Ryan speaking out. You saw the lovely Bill Barr speaking out. All of a sudden, he has an opinion, and so I think that what you're going to see is that we're kind of watching to see where this lands. We all thought a few months ago there was going to be DeSantis.
Right.
But I don't think he has enough going on in his backyard. And he's just almost as polarizing as Trump now. He carries some of that same baggage. So I don't know if it's going to be him. Nikki Haley, maybe. I'm not sure. She might benefit. Pence will not. I will tell you, Pence will probably not.
I mean, the one who seems to be, they're all a distant second, to Trump in the polls, but the one who seems to be moving the needle more than anybody else is Chris Christie. I just don't know how long that'll last.
Yeah, that's in the stunt category, I think.
It'll come out, the show's fun, and then it'll grow old and it'll move on.
I thought you were going to say South Carolina.
Asa Hutchinson?
No, Tim Scott.
Oh, Tim Scott.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that, but.
Well, I don't. In the poll numbers, I haven't seen those.
Oh, no, yeah.
I haven't seen that. The momentum of a Tim Scott.
Well, the thing you hear, and again, I don't know if this is right-wing talking points or not, but you do, the one, actually I've heard this on both sides, is at the same point in the Obama-Hillary cycle, you know, Hillary was a bazillion points ahead, you know, at the same point in the Trump, Cruz, whoever were the big players early on.
Jeb Bush?
Yeah, right. You know, they were a bazillion points ahead, you know. So the point being that things could change. I agree with you, though. I personally would have thought that DeSantis would have had a much stronger, really across the board, much stronger showing. You know, I thought he really came sputtering out. And right? Is that the word?
Well, I mean, so let's talk about that for a second, because we haven't quietly tweeting. We've talked around this, but I think directly is really interesting because it seemed as if once he announced, then nothing went right. But when you look at what led up to it, these were actions that he thought were going to put him in the best place possible. And perhaps to even eclipse Trump as the front runner, but they were such extreme actions that it didn't work out that way.
Right, and he's been bubble wrapped in Florida. I mean, if you think about it, they control the narrative. He controls who's in his press conferences. He gets to stomp his feet and act like a little dictator, and it hasn't played well. And not only that, I've said it before, Joe. I'll say it again. He's got the personality of a dust bunny. Okay, and when you look at Trump, okay, whether you like the guy or not, he pulls. I mean, he pulls a scary level of loyalty, some of which I still don't understand. But he is charismatic to a fault, and that's where I think the rest of the field gets left behind.
Yeah, I think I didn't know a lot about DeSantis. I mean, as the right wing person here, I really liked his policy, a lot of his policies, not all of them, in Florida. I was kind of waiting to see, all right, let's see how he transfers to the national stage. And even before this, you know, he took this weird view on Ukraine. He took a hit at Gavin Newsom. And I really get the feeling that either he has bad judgment or he's listening to people who are wrong, which is still bad judgment, right? You know, and he doesn't yet have the internal kind of security to override them. You know, boring could be a great selling point for him. You know, he could say, "Yes, I'm boring. Okay, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to say that. I'm boring, but I get things done." You know, and you could sell that. You know, but he's just really he's sputtering. We'll see if he gets himself together. If not, I think somebody's going to jump in.
I don't think you can sell boring until after primaries, though. You need to have enough excitement to get people to show up in a primary race.
Yeah, that might be true. Yeah, these days, that might be true just because of the fringe that votes, you know, in the primaries. But I don't know. I'm trying to think of
Didn't Biden get through on boring? Yeah, I think Biden got through our primaries on boring.
Yeah. Right up to South Carolina, he did.
But what Biden had, what the Republicans don't have is the person who, after the first three or four primaries, is going to call up, you know, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and say, "Guess what? You're done. Okay, we got a job for you. We got a role for you, but you're out. It's Joe Biden. That's it." You know, they don't have Obama to do that. There's nobody in the Republican Party who's going to do that.
Trump.
Not him. I don't know who picks up that phone and says, "All right, you know, everybody's had a shot, but now, you know, it's a week before Super Tuesday, or it's a day after Super Tuesday, and now it's time for us to close ranks." I don't know that I see that happening. That's why Biden was able to sell boring and non-present. You know what I mean? Because everybody fell very well in line. They were very well organized on that. I don't see anybody in the Republican Party doing that.
I mean, this is basically what you've said, I think. But it was a matter of stability. We had been through like we were the snow globe, and it was just like a rambunctious 18-month-old was just shaking it and shaking it and shaking it for 4 years. And then the snow globe got sick. And then somebody said, let's stop shaking the snow globe.
It's so funny that you say the 18-month-old, because when we on the right talk about another Trump presidency, what everybody says is, besides the fact that I'd want to vote for him again, I can't take the screaming 2-year-old in the plane for the next 6 hours,
right.
Which is not Trump. It's you guys. Okay, that's the screaming 2-year-old.
The woke snowflakes.
The everybody else, basically. You know, and I don't feel strongly enough about Trump to vote for him, and I sure don't feel strongly enough to vote for him and then put up with all that crap for the next 4 years. But it's funny. But same analogy, though.
But the schism, I mean, let's get back to the schism in the Republican Party, because we see it not just with the presidential contenders. We're seeing it with Congress. So if you start to think about what's going on in the House right now, where you basically have 11 lunatics that are political terrorists that are holding the country hostage. And, you know, I'm really intrigued by what I'm starting to see is with the sort of the more moderates in the GOP in the caucus pushing back, saying, listen, this isn't, you know, we're not going to let you continue to wag the dog. So I think I don't think we're done yet on this intercedent food fight in the Republican Party. And I would also note for Democrats that are listening, don't get too smug, because you have the exact same problem on the left. It's just been, I think, better managed. And I think there's some more rational actors on the left than there are on the right. And you start to think about Boebert and Gossard and some of the really wacky. Yeah. They're really, really wacky.
Anyone else? All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have letters, and we'll get to those. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. We have a great group this morning. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, our newest member to the panel. We're thrilled to have her. And Rich Honan, who is so thrilled to have Nick take his place. He'll be leaving in about 10 minutes. So thank you. Got a meeting?
I feel like I'm being dismissed. But
no,
okay.
No, you know I would love to have you here till 11. All right, let's go to letters. One juror, ? Please explain why it only takes one juror to sink the case against Trump. My prediction, a candidate who's not even on the radar will emerge and blow away the Republican field, like Tucker Carlson, for example.
Oh, I thought he was going to say Vivek.
Tucker.
My dream, an alliance of Democrat women will rise and say, Joe, enough. Thank you for your service. Now go home. I hope they mean Joe Biden.
I was going to say, just to answer our first question, yes, you need a unanimous jury to find someone guilty. So one juror could ruin, so to speak.
Well, could hang a jury.
Could hang a jury, so to speak, yes.
But they would be able to retry.
Right, yeah. Irene says Biden's old experience many years if making contacts and learning how to be presidential and make responsible decisions. No matter how boring he comes across, he's stable where Trump is chaos, and DeSantis is most likely not very popular outside of the Sunshine State.
Yeah, I don't think that's the issue, but I do think the issue of age is a legitimate concern and capacity to keep up with the job.
I agree. He did an excellent job with the debt ceiling negotiations, getting that done in time. So, but, you know, we were hopeful that there was someone else coming up, because tell me if I'm wrong, but I recall him saying that I'm only going to run for one term.
No, you know, no,
he never said that.
He certainly doesn't recall that.
No,
you remember he never said that.
Really?
But no matter
the feeling. Yeah. I feel like that was a feeling.
No, but no matter what, you know, 90 may be the new 80, but 80 is still old. You know, he's.
I know I've said this. I know I've said this many, 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 many times. But here's what I don't understand about the American people. So they voted for a guy who was 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Did they not think he was going to add age numbers?
Yeah, but Joe, they didn't
continue his term.
They didn't know how compromised he was. they didn't know how old he really was. They didn't, because he was a lot stronger. He seemed a lot stronger and a lot more in control during the few campaign appearances. And then either he went down precipitously, or just once you saw him more. I don't know that people would look at him now and say, yes, we want another 4 years in a year.
Well, I mean, compared to the orange guy, absolutely. But let me say it slightly differently. We're at that stage in American politics where what we're doing is that in each of our minds, we're looking for what is the most perfect candidate for president. Okay, so you look at all of these factors and you say, you know, I want this and I want that and I want this and I want somebody who's going to be vibrant and well-spoken and represent the country and is going to be strong but is going to be empathetic. We're at that stage and you know, and you're looking at what the potential choices are, and you're sort of doing the, well, you know, I like this feature, I don't like that feature. It's kind of like buying a car right now, and we're just getting to the stage where we're going to start to test drive. So, I mean, I think it's just a natural part of where we are in the political cycle.
Let's see. This letter comes from Emma. Let's just assume Trump's legal team will work to make sure this trial takes at least 17 months past Election Day 2024. Very likely. The next months will be filled with trial room dramas. Instead of focusing on those dramas and knowing that the trial outcome is uncertain, instead, let's focus our energies on grassroots organizing to elect Democratic candidates up and down the ballot in 2024. That's what ultimately matters. The mere fact that Trump has been indicted is historic and critically important to the continuation of our democracy. That from Emma.
Well, I think they've already succeeded in that. Look at last year's midterms. I assume she's a Democrat. I think they've already done a really good job at getting out the vote and, you know, attacking issues at the grassroots level. Right. That was supposed to be a historic red wave. And look how well the Democrats did. So I think she's on the right track.
Peter, so go ahead.
Well, and I do think that as the trial continues, Democratic candidates will use pieces of anything that comes out of Trump to support ongoing Democratic campaigns. I mean, the longer that case goes on, the more opportunities for Trump to say ridiculous things and the more fodder to add to that fire.
Oh, yeah. He's an annuity. He's an annuity for the Democratic Party, right?
Absolutely. I mean,
he's just a gift that keeps on giving.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, you just think of how many more months you have before the, like, that's...
Oh, I thought you were going to say it makes you wonder if he's getting a piece of it.
No, it's just wearying, isn't it? I mean, I think it's all wearying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is not the last indictment, allegedly.
Well, right.
Because you still have Georgia.
Yeah. Well, two more, right? They're Georgia and then, of course, January
6th.
Yeah,
January 6th. Yeah. So... potential two more. So we're not even done yet.
Right.
All right. Let's see. We go to this from, I'll find a name, I promise. I can't think, this is from James. I can't think of any Democrat, Barack Obama included, who I would rather have seen negotiating the debt ceiling than Joe Biden. At the same time, would you like oxygen, Rich? I can't think of any Democrat or Republican who I would rather see setting our policy for Ukraine and our NATO policies than Joe Biden. There is no one more experienced and eminently qualified to lead the country on both domestic and international fronts, and I am grateful that he is our president during these extremely challenging times. The sooner the entire Democratic Party gets behind his reelection, the better for our country and our democracy. That from James.
Brought to you by Joe Biden for President 24.
Yeah, but let me ask a different question from that letter. Okay, I appreciate what you said about getting behind the candidate. What happens, God forbid, if something happens to Joe Biden? What's the Democratic what is the Democratic Party's answer to something catastrophic happens and you now have to run a primary? Who's next?
And I see, this is where I think a lot of people are concerned. We had the Justice Ginsburg situation, right? With, you know, we're seeing what's happening with Feinstein right now. And so I think that's why most Democrats are speaking out and saying, Biden he's doing an excellent job, for what but we're worried about what happens. What's the what if? And I think that answer, like, what does that look like? Because we haven't seen enough of Vice President Harris. right? So I just, that's our concern. I think it's not so much that Biden has done a poor job. It's that historically in the last few years, we've had situations where we've been placed in poor positions because someone didn't leave at the right time.
You know, he never said it directly. And but I think it was always assumed, and I don't think party leadership did anything to sway people's opinion or thoughts on this or to change this impression, which is I'm Joe Biden. I'm going to be in my 80s when I run again. I'm going to get our country out of the condition that it's in after 4 years of Trump. And by the way, I am going to name this dynamic Vice President Kamala Harris, who we will set up to be in perfect order that if I decide I don't want to go on or I'm unable to go on, that here she is to take over and will be a very valuable vice president. It seems where things went really off offline was that never really happened. And I'm not blaming Kamala Harris. It just doesn't seem like the administration. Well, I'm blaming her a little bit, but I don't think the administration did a whole lot to say, okay, we're gonna set you up. This is gonna be not a dual presidency, but certainly a very much a partnership presidency.
Yeah, well, I think that's because Biden either decided or finally revealed that I'm going for two terms. I'm not in this for one term. I don't know whether that's something he changed his mind on once he got there or whether that was always his plan. But you can't blame Kamala Harris for the position that the administration placed her in. I don't think, say what you want, I don't think she was, they always talk in management about putting people in a position to succeed. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that anybody's ever been placed in a position to fail more than she has been. Although I will say, her job was also to get them elected, and she did that. All right, I mean, I'm not saying she was the only one, but she brought a lot of people to that ticket. The other thing I'll say is, and I'm not here to defend Kamala Harris, is
doing a good job.
We're enjoying it.
Really. I mean, look. She hasn't, kind of like DeSantis. She has her opportunities and been fumbling around a little bit, but she hasn't been. The administration hasn't done her any favors, and I think that came from Biden. I don't think that came from her.
Look at what happened with the debt ceiling. They would have just brought her into that conversation, made her part of that negotiation more. Put that, you know, it just makes people feel more confident, and it's just little optics like situations like that would be very helpful for the country.
There was a point where they weren't even sending her to funerals.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what the vice president's supposed to do.
That's right.
Yeah. But, you know, when I was talking about sort of that mythical idea of what we want out of a presidency and vice presidency, one of the things that I deeply appreciate about the Obama presidency is I felt that it was a team, that I felt that he utilized his vice president better than anybody that I can remember in my lifetime. And I really liked that model because I felt that there was strong leadership at the top that was a force multiplier, and I would like any candidate who could come up with that model again would be great.
I think Biden was also at the height of his, I'm going to say height of his powers, and I don't mean mentally. I think Biden was at the height of his game then, and what he was good at then was exactly what the Obama team needed. You know, kind of the person who, you know, he worked the Senate, could shake hands with John McCain, you know, could work the whole thing, get things done. I think, and I don't know that, that's what Biden needed from Harris. The other thing, I'll say one more thing about Kamala Harris. I know, especially on the right, people love to make fun of her, but I don't think there's the delta between Biden and Harris that there was, for example, between FDR and Truman. I mean, how do you think people thought of Harry Truman, you know, a week before FDR passed away? I'm sure the delta between the public trust in them was way larger than the one between Biden and Harris.
Well, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. Truman didn't even know.
He didn't know about the atom bomb.
He didn't know anything. They had kept him out of every meeting and just said, you know, you stay in Washington.
Yeah. And Truman did, you know, arguably Truman did pretty well, right? So if I was on the Harris team, I'd be pointing out some of those. historical facts?
I think it could potentially. So I think in the Obama-Biden situation, Biden lended his credibility to Obama in a way that made Obama's decision-making more effective to the public. But I do think there's a scenario or an option here where with Biden and Harris kind of stays out of the public eye until it's opportune to be more present. Like there could be a strategy there that keeps her sort of out of the Biden, vitriol, if you will, until there's something more positive to bring her into and give her that sort of name recognition.
I'd like to think that. I don't know that they're thinking that. I'd like to think that. You know, I would. I think the administration's been unfair to her, and that's just where it is.
Rich Honan, your paperwork has come in from HQ. You are dismissed. Thank you very much for being with us.
It was nice seeing everybody. Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
We look forward to having you back, maybe for the full time. It'd be great. We'll be back.
I nodded. For those of you on the radio, I nodded. That was not stony silence.
When we come back, we will continue our conversation with the three members of the panel who do not have Rich's agent, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A good one underway here and in Studio A. It's 8 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Wednesday, the 14th of June. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert is here, Bob Griffin, and our newest member of our panel and to our family of panelists, Nick Rangel, who is Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York.
Thank you.
Having fun?
I'm having so much fun.
Oh, good. Oh, good, good, good. Well, you made it through the break, which that's good. Sometimes they say they're going, quote, out for coffee. Never see them again. So that's good. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go. I just want to talk a little bit about the arraignment itself, and I guess that was, sort of what we expected it to be, but it, what do we know about the judge? What do we know about who's going to oversee this case? What do we know about as it moves forward, especially in Florida, because it was the reason they wanted it in Florida.
Yeah, because Florida is where most of the acts took place, so they have jurisdiction. So he didn't want to further prolong it by fighting about jurisdictional issues. So Jack Smith, rightfully so, put it in Florida. It was assigned back to Judge Cannon, who, if everybody recalls, did the very bad special master's ruling, where she was yelled at by the 11th Circuit for not upholding the law. It was a very scathing decision that came down for her. So it's back in front of Judge Cannon. Yesterday, it was in front of a duty magistrate judge, but it's back in front of Judge Cannon. And so everyone's watching Judge Cannon. Like, eyes are on Judge Cannon. The prosecutors are watching Judge Cannon. Trump's defense team is hoping that Judge Cannon works in their favor. So that's where they're at right now with the judges. And my opinion is that Judge Cannon is going to, dot her I's, cross her T's. She's not going to go out of her way to help the defense team after what happened to her last time with the special master ruling.
Can you explain why you think that? And it's also, it was a random selection, right? There was like a 6% chance.
It was a random selection. It was based on individuals' dockets, how they determined it. But I just think that she's already been yelled, she's already been scolded. You can't say anything less than that. Scolded in an opinion by the 11th Circuit.
But about this case.
About this case, about the special master case, right?
So whenever, doesn't that somehow make you not qualified to oversee the case?
I mean, it went through the proper channels. She made a decision. They appealed the decision. The 11th Circuit said there was a poor decision that she made. And now she's back to being a judge. It's okay. But the problem is that if she makes another poor decision, case in point, the attorney-client privilege issue that's going to come up and the crime fraud exception that's going to come up, that has been established by two D.C. judges, federal judges. They made that decision. If she overturns that, then you're going to see the prosecution, Jack Smith's team, appeal it, and they will probably at that point ask her to be taken off the case by the 11th Circuit. And there's a high likelihood that the 11th Circuit would take her off because she's already made a poor decision in the past in the same decision. So they're just watching her right now. I don't think they're going to do a motion to recuse for her, the prosecution. They're not going to do that. They're going to watch and see how her decisions are made. But she will get away with smaller decisions, like, you know, maybe moving to delay, maybe moving to push a motion off a few more weeks. She can get away with those types of decisions. We're talking about decisions on the defense's prosecutorial issues that they're saying, misconduct. Those kind of issues are what everyone's going to be watching her decision-making on.
The substance, yeah.
But then why wouldn't, if you were Smith, why wouldn't you more proactively try to get her reclused from the beginning if she could still damage the case given her history? And I mean, the record was abysmal. I mean, I felt that she should have been removed from the bench for what she did, but that's, you know, I'm a layman in your world.
I think they're already saying, like, if I was in Jack Smith's position, I would do similar thing, because they're already saying this is a political move. So I would just leave it until she actually makes a mistake and you have a reason to recuse her, if she's not going to recuse herself. I think they would have supported her if she recused herself, which probably would have been smart. She probably should have just said, I don't want any more parts of this of this hearing. But she has not done so. We know that because she signed the orders for the pro hac vice, for the local council. So we know that she wants to move forward with this case. And maybe to her, it's an opportunity to prove herself as a fair and impartial judge. So she might see this opportunity to be more fair and impartial. But Jack Smith's team is just watching and waiting. The minute she messes up, they're going to appeal and they're going to take it to the 11th Circuit. And because we're dealing with confidential documents, they get expedited appeal to the 11th Circuit. So they're just waiting for her to make a decision that's contrary to what they want. And then they'll probably move on it.
I think Jack Smith's team also, they have to let somebody else make the call on whether she can preside over that case.
Like, exactly.
They can't be who pushes her, you know, off the bench for this.
And they have a strong case, right?
Oh.
And it's going to be cited by a jury of his peers. So ultimately, it comes down to the evidence and what the jury decides. It's not, you know, she'll deal with evidentiary issues, admissibility issues, but ultimately it comes down to the jury.
This is also,
well,
though,
in the instructions, right?
In instructions.
I do think that there's a lot of room for her to have influence over the jury and the instructions.
Exactly.
I also think that this is a prime example of why there should be cameras in the federal courts. That I think as a people, we should be able to watch and monitor what's going on with the judicial branch of the federal government. And I don't understand it. I don't agree with this, the arguments that I've heard come out of the federal court system, but I'd be interested in your perspectives on that.
I completely agree. I think there needs to be cameras, and we need to know what's going on, because it serves as a deterrent for defense counsel to put up, you know, all sorts of silly motions that they want to do. So now we don't even know what Trump's defense team is going to argue until they already do it, versus if they knew they were being watched by the public, they may have more nuanced, more sophisticated arguments that they bring, because they know people are watching these arguments. So
I wonder if there's a concern to some degree around, like, what kind of evidence is presented in a federal case. So in this scenario, we're talking about highly confidential, protected documents that we wouldn't want that evidence, like, necessarily shown in the public. And how deep of a dive do they do on the content of the documents that we're talking about?
Yeah, but that's already regulated by SIPA. So SIPA is going to determine whether or not the jury can see it and they'll watch it.
What's SIPA?
The confidential. Don't make me do this.
You don't have to tell
the
me.
Confidential
basically what
identification
they do.
Something like that. It's the way to determine how they're going to show the classified documents. I would mess up the order of the words.
But showing it to the jury is different than having it live on camera for the public.
Exactly. So they would regulate that.
You'd have to have an extra layer of protection that maybe is, you know, logistically difficult.
Well, Joe's got a big red button. I'm sure they could figure out a big red button for the federal court system. I mean, that's just a technology issue. It's these are just obstacles into why we treat the judiciary as having godlike powers when they should just be another branch of government, in my mind.
Is that the Securities Investor Protection Act?
CIPA.
CIPA.
I think it's CIPA.
Okay.
The what I was going to say is my husband was watching yesterday, and he was like, "We're looking at sketches. Is it the wrong one?"
No, I read.
And he was seeing the sketches. He's like, and he's a technology guy. He's like, in this age of technology, I'm looking at sketches. Like, you know, like it just seems very disconnected.
Bad sketches.
Yeah, I mean, they're okay, but
I'm just cartoony.
Saying,
like I thought, I mean, I loved when they put it on the New Yorker cover. That's awesome, but it is odd.
It does seem odd. It doesn't seem along with the times. We have like you know AI things that can write emails for you, and we have this sketch of Donald Trump by hand with colored pencils.
I know I'm snarky. I wish we could get the guy from Far Side to go in there and do the
little Gary Larson action. Just one of the things to your point is that you can do it without having quote unquote cameras in the courtroom, which would also mean that you would have press in the courtroom. But if you had just a camera in the courtroom that was focused on three different points, and you snapped a shot and you took it, well, that would be different. But the whole point would be to be able to witness it and hear it and find out what's going on, especially when it involves the President of the United States, the former President of the United States, who is the front runner in the next election.
And CIPA is the Classified Information Procedures Act. Sorry.
There we go. All right. Thank you. I wasn't coming up with that. I came up with a lot of different things, but not that. Let's see. Let's go to we do have letters, and I want to get to those before we move on to other topics this morning. Judge Cannon, I'm sure she's learned her lesson, says Steve. No disrespect to other panel members, but if at all possible, Joe, please make an executive decision to make today's panel members permanent.
It's my first time. I love that comment.
I thought that was going left. I was like, oh.
Yeah. No, I
was bracing.
I had to read it twice just to make sure where we were headed, but we're fine.
That's the game.
People will. So if you were to meet, and he's in hospice, and let's say Clinton. If you were to meet Clinton, President Clinton, you would say Mr. President. You would say President Clinton.
Yes.
When we do that or we would do that with Bush, we would do that with Carter, and when we do it with Trump, our listeners go nuts. Their little brains just go not little brains. I don't mean that, but you're just like. And we get so many letters about, please, please, please do not call him president. Well, he was president of the United States for 4 years. And I know what you're going to say, because I read the letters every day. You're going to say, well, he wasn't really elected. He didn't win the Electoral College. Got it.
It's former President Trump. I mean, but it's also, you know, when our own Fred Hoff is on, I mean, technically we should be calling him Ambassador Hoff. I mean, that's the respect.
He likes your excellency better.
For some down to earth man, it's so funny. You know, President, I'm going no, but it's just being respectful and that it is, whether you like it or not. I mean, he was the president, and he was sworn in as the president, so he gets the title.
Yeah.
All right. We should all be carefully watching Elise Stefanik with our guard up. She is angling for the White House at the side of the former guy. Well, she's been doing that since the first court. Since the Brett Kavanaugh.
Well, after she did the drive-by killing of Liz Cheney, I mean, she's been. I mean, you think about. I mean, I think she was behind the wheel of the truck that hit Liz Cheney. She had no problem moving into the leadership. So yeah, I think that she's that's exactly what she wants. I don't think she's been shy about it.
Yeah.
I mean.
No. Not sure what the vice president has had the opportunities to speak publicly. That the vice president has projected firm confidence, resolve, and strength, which might be critical in perception of her leadership ability. If that is a fair assessment, might the vice president be a boon or a bust for Biden's reelection, considering the vice president is the person who is one heartbeat from the presidency?
I don't think that Biden should or could change the vice presidency right now. It creates unnecessary drama. It gives the folks on the right the opportunity to poke at his, the initial logic. It creates a divide within the Democratic Party. You don't change now.
No, not at all.
All right. Let's go to some new topics here as we move on. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes before our bottom of the hour break as we near the end of our time together. Now, I just have to find them. And that, I know that's the problem.
Well, you're going to do McCarthy? You're going to do E. Jean Carroll?
Well, let's do McCarthy. Let's do McCarthy. So what is happening there, do you think, Bob, as far as he is? I mean, you mentioned this earlier on, so that's why I'm going to you first. But you talked about, basically he's everything's on hold. He has shut down the House
yep.
for all practical purposes. But I'm guessing if Democrats did that, there would be a different reaction.
Yeah. I think we can, if I could sort of summarize where I think we are with the House right now is play stupid games, win stupid prizes. And the far right Freedom Caucus, and we're talking about a handful of members, have been flexing their muscle. They flexed it with the 15 votes it took to get him into the speakership. They have been granted an inordinate amount of power by the rest of the House, and they were unhappy with the debt ceiling limit. I mean, we're talking about people that were more than willing to not only light the nation's economy on fire, but drive it over a cliff. So they were upset that there was actually a compromise deal that Republicans and Democrats voted on. So we can frame what the Freedom Caucus really is. And they decided to use some of the minutia of House rules about how bills come to the floor as a way of terrorizing the rest of the organization and until McCarthy stands up to them, or until there is some sort of understanding with Jeffries and the Democrats that we have to do something different, then we could be facing gridlock in the House, which frankly means that the Republicans' agenda is not even going to have a chance to see the light of day in the Senate because it's not going to get out of the House.
I think the fact that the Freedom Caucus won so many concessions in the 15 votes to get McCarthy elected Speaker gave them a lot of power, and now they're in a position where they know that they can win those concessions if they fight hard enough. It was probably a choice McCarthy had to make at the time, but I think he's regretting that. The decision or the choices that were made to allow that to happen.
Well he let them go running naked through the halls, and it's his job to remind them that they are 11 meaningless votes. Okay, that's what they are. They are votes from fringe districts that don't reflect any reality in the rest of the country, and until he curbs his crazies, then there's going to be problems. And it also just reminds everybody how impotent he is as a speaker.
But he's not making any attempt to bring them in line or to harness the crazy, other than because without them he's toast. And there was an article in Politico this morning, it basically said, well, okay, we have a temporary agreement. This will go for like a week. And then he's going to have this problem again 2 days after that and 4 days after that and 8 days after that until he's removed.
And the irony is he has to go over, cross the aisle probably to get a lot of his things done, which is really what we want in the first place. So I see a silver lining to all of this if they want to get anything done.
Well, unless their efforts to change the rules of the House actually are successful, right? Like, that's their point. So McCarthy's not toast without those marginal votes if the bills that he moves forward have bipartisan support. And then you can still get some stuff done. What the Freedom Caucus is trying to do is even undermine even that opportunity by taking away the possibility of those bipartisan bills in the reform of the rules of the House and how bills get to the floor.
This is a bunch of toddlers who are throwing a tantrum, and he keeps appeasing them. This is like a child in the toy aisle in Target who is melting down, and rather than him disciplining that child or dealing with the situation, well, Daddy will buy you a new toy, please, you know, and all he's doing is appeasing them and giving them more power than they really have.
I understand that. I'm sorry.
I think if you call it discipline, I think actually the pressure has to come from the party on the outside. There's only so much that as Speaker he can do to get his, you know, his conference together. But if the party is not coming to those members and saying, we will withdraw our support, we will not help you win your next election, you need to get in line, then I think McCarthy's sort of at a loss.
Well, then he made a deal with the devil, right?
Yes.
And so when I hear you say that, Bob, about the analogy of throwing a tantrum in the toy aisle, yeah, but those kids have the keys to the car and are able to bring everybody back and have seems to have more of the map home than the speaker does.
But Joe, they don't. You see, this is just it. They only do because Kevin McCarthy's ego is tied with him being speaker. If you'd call his bluff and say, you really want to play this game, I'll call your bluff out. We'll keep going and more, you know, you want to recall me? Recall me. We'll play that game because then, you know, let it burn. But right now what they're doing is that they're continually appeasing and it's not working. And you're right. It's you know, we'll get a week apiece, and then one of those wing nuts is going to get another crazy idea, and they're going to get angry again, and we're going to play this to the point where nothing gets done. So at some point he's going to have to face the music. He's going to have to bring it to a head at some point. He might as well bring it to a head now.
I just think that you have to kind of, you know, zoom out a little bit. The Freedom Caucus has the most vocal support by Trump. Trump is at the front of the Republican Party. He is the front runner for the Republican presidential candidate. McCarthy undermining the Freedom Caucus puts the party and the House at odds with Donald Trump. And there is, I think, a lot of nuance there that's not just, you know, McCarthy can't get along with these 11 folks.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have our last go-round with our terrific panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning.
It's a tough break, Joe.
Yeah. Where were you? Where were you brought up?
Ohio.
Ohio. We were just talking about convenience store culture to Siena, and I didn't. What convenience stores did you have in Ohio?
We had 7-Elevens, and we knew not to eat ice cream from there or to drink coffee from there unless you're in dire straits. So I don't.
All right, we won't get.
I felt like the referee. There was an argument about Stewart's and Cumberland Farms, and I thought there was going to be some unnecessary roughness.
No, we're okay. We're all right. We're just. It's interesting to me. Fascinating. although my favorite part of that was Seattle looked at my peanut butter and butter hard roll and said, what is that sandwich? And Nick said, well, that's the iconic label. A peanut butter and butter sandwich. It's the iconic label. I like that.
Everyone recognizes Stewart's Hard Roll sticker.
That's right. Everyone knows.
Ate Stewart's Hard Rolls every day. I don't know.
So when you wonder what erudite conversations go on during
break. Yeah, that's it. That's right. Yep. Absolutely. Okay. Let's go on to...
Before we can go...
Yeah, sure.
Can I just make one final point on the last subject?
Absolutely.
But I mean, this is also an issue that's affecting the Senate. And if people haven't been paying attention, Tuberville from Alabama, who you know, his claim to fame was a failed football coach, has put a block on the appointments of officers, which is typically just a rubber stamp, more ceremonial process of the United States Marines, and it's holding up. And it's actually, I believe, starting to impact the fighting capacity of the Marines. But this is the level of damage that we have some members of Congress that are willing to make to make cheap political points at the expense of either the country's national security, certainly its military, or economy. And it's something I think we need to all collectively call out.
Anybody else? All right. Let's move. Excuse me. Let's move on.
Thank you for that letter of support.
Yeah, that's right. let's move on to other topics, and we'll go to the inflation. The latest inflation snapshot comes as the Federal Reserve is expected to leave rates untouched at this week's policy meetings. It has eased in May, but remains above normal levels. In light of the latest inflation snapshot, the Federal Reserve is expected to leave rates untouched. However, the fight to tame prices has come a long way since last June, when inflation peaked at 40-year highs, reaching 9.1% on a year-over-year basis in June 2022. As the Federal Reserve struggled to rein in prices, experts feared that the central bank would have to move to more aggressively to slow the economy, that it would cause a recession. But the latest snapshot shows a different picture. Even if it is not one of pure success, a report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that came out yesterday showed that inflation eased for the 11th straight month in May. Prices rose 4% in comparison with a year earlier, the smallest 12-month increase since March 2021, and an improvement from the 4.9% annual rate in April. Prices also rose to 0.1% in May over the previous month. If you were the Joe Biden administration, how do you spin that?
Send out Kamala Harris.
I mean, I think compared to the EU, compared to Britain, I think we're doing exceptionally well. What I'd actually be keeping an eye on is the projections for sort of the next housing bubble crash coming in the next 2 to 3 years, and the price of timber due to the wildfires out of Canada. And I think those outlooks look pretty poor, even if today's numbers in comparison to other countries look pretty good.
It's also, I think, the difficulty for any sitting administration with a situation like this, because collectively we all spend a lot more time yelling at Joe Biden when gas prices were going up, even though he had no control over it. And nobody is driving by the gas stations right now and going, "Oh, good Joe, good job, Joe. That's great." You're just looking at the prices and going, "Yeah, okay, that's the price of gas today." But when it was going up, everybody was throwing stuff against the wall, and you know, we're getting letters, and you know, it was crazy. I mean, he can go take some credit. Some credit for it, but it unfortunately for him it falls sort of on deaf ears, because people blame the administration. Look, they're not doing anything, but we don't really allow them to take credit when the prices are coming down. It's good trends. I think your point about the issue of lumber is really interesting, and I don't think we've really thought through what that implication is and what that means for that whole logistics trail. And of course, housing is always the sort of one of those leading indicators of the wellness that we have as not only as an economy but as a nation and a community.
Santa?
Yeah. So I guess what I will say, and I speak for myself, is that most people don't really understand the implications of inflation unless it's hitting in their pocket at home, right? So, like, what I watch every week is how expensive are eggs. Like, that's, you know, we watch that price go up high, right? And higher and higher. And we haven't really seen much of a decrease there, right? Whereas I don't use gas, but, you know, maybe there's been a decrease in gas. So I think for individuals, I think they want to hear more about that. I think that's what President Biden and his team could do, is talk about how you're seeing, you know, if they're seeing prices go. But he should be very careful, too, because, as you said, there's bubbles coming up. So maybe he just says, we're trying to work on it and keep it moving, you know. But I just think that this is not something to highlight at this moment.
It's an interesting observation. Gas is really the only thing that you can drive down the street and see prices and see that prices actually change as you're driving down the street sometimes. You don't see, I mean, you don't see the price of milk or a dozen eggs up on 15 different boards as you drive down.
I have an electric car, Stewart's. So.
Yeah. You know, no, Stewart's does not. Stewart's doesn't put the...
No, I was saying, I have an electric car, so I don't pay attention, so I can speak to it. Like, personally, I can speak to, like, the prices going up and down.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just... For me, groceries matter, right? Like, mm-hmm. you're feeding your family, and you're trying... You have your budget every month for how much you're going to spend. That's where we've seen the most hit in our pocket, is with groceries and how much it costs to serve a nutritious meal.
That's all you're trying to do.
That's all I'm trying to do.
All right. Let's, did you have something?
The only other observation I was going to make too is that it's coming at a bad time for the administration. It's always a good time for inflation to come down, but you know, we don't want to talk about inflation. We want to talk about summer vacations and, you know, going to the beach and getting the kids out of school. I mean, it's one of those interesting times. It's sort of like that time right before or right during the holiday season when, you know, you could do the most amazing thing as a politician and everybody's like, just leave me alone. I just want to be with my family.
Mm-hmm. Final thing up for item up for bids here is, and I don't know how many of you are fans, but this one hit hard yesterday, was the passing of Cormac McCarthy. Cormac McCarthy was a brilliant Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, won the Pulitzer twice, I believe, and was really an interesting, reclusive, very tough to sort of put a finger on, wrote very dark, brooding, violent, very... a lot of testosterone novels, and yet we're pretty good. In fact, he was a brilliant writer, an absolutely brilliant writer, known for All the Pretty Horses and the Border Trilogy, as well as No Country for Old Men and the Road, two of his books that were made into very, very successful films. And he died at the age of 89. And in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he was the closest thing to sort of the next generation of a Harper Lee, who really refused interviews. I think he gave, I think, five in his career. One was with Oprah. But what's great is that he didn't really say anything in them. You're like, oh, my God, Cormac McCarthy's getting interviewed. I can't wait to read this. And then you read it and you're like, oh, there's nothing. He didn't really say anything. And when often posed with the question of which I am often, people often ask me who would I most like to interview, and I always had Cormac McCarthy on my list because I thought that would be really cool to interview Cormac McCarthy, because he was one of my literary heroes. He had two books, one called The Passenger, one called Stella Maris, that came out in the fall of last year. And you know, they weren't quite up to the normal standards, but it was still, you know, even bad Cormac McCarthy is better than most. I don't know. Has anyone ever read?
I just wanted to ask which was your favorite, so I can add it to my summer reading
list.
Oh,
well, I think either the see, here's the thing. When I do this, then if you read it, you're going to blame me because it's just going to depress the life out of you. But either The Road or No Country for Old Men.
Okay.
Yeah. And I maybe The Road is really, man, that's really good. It's an amazing novel. So we lost him yesterday. Very sad news. But 89 and an incredible figure in in the world of literature. So
I liked the description that he was a writer's writer.
Yes.
I thought that was an interesting take.
Yeah, I think that's and that's true. Yeah, you enjoy the sentences, and sometimes you're like, oh, I wonder, I'm sorry, what is he talking about? But this is beautiful to read. We are out of time. I want to thank our group here. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you all here. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Bob Griffin, and Nick Rangel. Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I also will take this opportunity to remind folks that we're holding an opening reception at Legal Aid Society tonight from 4 to 8. And we are displaying winning photographers in our building. So there is an exhibit as well.
Excellent. Wonderful stuff. All right. Well, congratulations. Thank you for being here. And thanks also to Rich, who had to leave early. We'll be back right after this.